Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Typical, disgusting display.
Tonight, we got them. Goldie and the Sulk.
This is a typical, disgusting, disgusting display.
And it starts right now.
Oh. Great intro. Hey, welcome or welcome back. This is episode 3 of A Typical Disgusting Display with Goldie and the Sulk, a podcast for writers by writers who hate writing. Really short title. Really not regretting
that. But love podcasting.
Love. We love it. We love just sitting there. We don't love writing.
Yeah.
Of course, joining us as always is our producer, JC Brooks. JC, how are you today?
I am well. For real. For real.
Okay, good. I believe you today. Okay, I believe good. And Goldie, we'll just assume you're fine.
Yeah. So what the listeners will never know and appreciate is this is our second attempt to start this podcast. And our first was such a fumbled kickoff that after I heard the phrase dog Auschwitz, I had to call it and say, we need to start over. We're okay. On such a bad path here. And here we are starting again. And
we instantly agreed. We instantly agreed.
Yes.
I don't know. We got down the wrong road there very
it
fast.
It was 40 seconds in. What happened?
I don't know. I tried to talk about your legs and you kind of skirted the subject. But let's talk about something more uplifting than doggy Auschwitz. My daughter, I had a T-ball game this morning.
Oh.
She just started doing this year. She's 5, playing in a T-ball league with other 4, 5, and 6-year-olds.
Yeah.
I kind of liked the idea of it. I was excited to go to like a little league field. And like, I remember doing that as a kid and it was fun. It was a fucking nightmare. I don't know if you've been, Goldie, did your kids playing
league.
A T-ball league or anything like
that?
No. It's a very East Coasty kind of thing. It's like ingrained in people over here, whereas in California,
is this
in LA.
Baseball or softball?
Well, it looks like a baseball, but it is soft. So it's like the weirdest of both worlds.
Is it put on a tee, right?
On a tee. Yeah. On a tee. So it's just everybody bats, which is fine. Nobody's out.
Oh, no.
It just keeps going that everybody scores. So the final score, they do 3 innings, is always like 39-39. You know, it's something ridiculous. And you have to wait for everyone to do it, including kids who are just way too small. And you know how everything's so, you know, in Massachusetts, it's like, he's bringing his little brother this week. Isn't he adorable? And then a kid who just can't even pick up a bat and you have to wait for him to actually make contact.
Yeah. Are they wearing helmets too?
They're wearing helmets and there's no ball. There's no danger of being hit by a ball, right. But they are still wearing these oversized helmets that make their heads kind of flop to the side. And so it's annoying. And then it's stressful when your kid is up. Because you want them to do well or at least listen. So Levy has this thing. Levy pulled off that almost like a Bugs Bunny Looney Tunes thing where she did a swing, completely missed, spun around, did a 360, and then hit the ball accidentally on her 360 way through. And everybody's like, go, go. And, you know, she never goes to first. It's always like this thing that we talk about going to the game and coming home from the game.
Is there a practice to...
They have practice. Okay. Well, that's another story, because I heard all these nightmare tales from the coach about Levy and her good friend Courtney, and they're just thick as thieves already manipulating, lying to people. So, you know, apparently they made up some story that Levy had lost her glove over the fence, and so they just skipped practice and were gone. You know, and they found her glove in her bag in the dugout. It was, yeah, it's a nightmare already. So she doesn't practice.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound like she wants to do
no,
it.
No, she's not, and that's okay. Like, no one's expecting her to get, like, a softball scholarship to, you know, University of Texas or anything. But it would just be nice if she could run to first. Like, I don't need
Where
her.
Where does she run to?
Well, eventually she runs to first. But it's, like, the process. That's why I have vocal fry today, you know, from 30 years of smoking pot and also yelling this morning. So I'm going to blame it on this morning, because I'm yelling at Levy, go to first. Go!
My daughter's first season of soccer, this is maybe 10 games, she didn't touch the ball once.
Oh, my God.
And so...
Did she not want to?
Oh, no. Well, that's unclear. Okay. But so then I said, okay, I need to volunteer as coach and be a little more hands-on, awesome. Which was...
No, not in soccer,
so
not hands-on.
So they lure you in and they say, it's not a big commitment. It's just the game, which is 2 hours, and a practice, which is 2 hours. But then you say, I'll do it. And then all of a sudden they were like, we were a little bit inaccurate when we said it's not a big commitment. And it's like, there's safety seminars and harassment training and all this stuff. And so I was going to these seminars, and then I had to secure the jerseys from a different part of Los Angeles and bring them in. And then I had to contact each parent, and I was just totally freaking out. And I'm like, I got to quit. What have I gotten myself into? And then coronavirus. And I was so psyched. And I still feel like it was a good trade for me. It's like, even with a year and a half of no school and everything, I got out of being a soccer coach.
Oh my
and of
God.
Course, this week they were like, should we pick up where we left off? And I said, absolutely not.
No.
You can't.
No.
You can't.
You can't.
No.
No, I mean, yeah, the only aspect of being a soccer coach that I would like would be having that net bag slung over my shoulder and then dumping out a bunch of soccer. Like, that's the only part I like. And then everybody else do everything.
The other half of it that was thankfully, again, COVID came, was I've never played soccer. So I've never participated in a single soccer game. So I do not know the rules. I know no hands. And I don't really know anything. But by the time they're 9 and 10, which is how old my kid is, the kids are kind of serious and the parents are really serious. So they were coming up to me and being like, what are your plans for, you know, offense? And it's like, what are my plans? My plan is called the free-for-all.
What kind of lineup are you looking at?
Oh, my God. They would have made a Bad News Bears-style movie about you as that coach.
You know why I wasn't allowed to play, I think? Because my mom, the scourge of her life, was grass stains on your pants. Just something I feel like you never hear about anymore.
I know. Well, they got all the fancy bleaches and
these are new tough skins. There's grass stains all over them. Sorry, I didn't realize I was supposed to keep my Sears pants in a glass case. God forbid a thread is out of place on these $8 pants that have the consistency of coarse sandpaper.
Wait, did you not go to Filene's basement, or was that a special treat?
That came later.
Okay.
That my parents discovered that, and then that became every Friday night for 4 years. And my dad, I told this story at his funeral, but he was so proud that he got a Brooks Brothers, a real Brooks Brothers seersucker suit. Originally $350, marked down to $250, marked down to $200, marked down to $100, marked down to $68, He got this suit for $7.50 at Filene's basement.
You told that at his funeral?
Yeah, because didn't he also
serve in World War II and you chose to talk about Filene's basement at his funeral?
Yes.
Yeah. I love it.
Keep it light.
I know. I love that. That's right. No, we don't need dog Auschwitz.
The point was that the less he paid for something, the more he valued it.
Of course.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. My dad absolutely is like that. I mean, he's incredibly frugal. I remember one of the funniest, he had gotten these special windshield wipers that had like three blades, you know, because we were in Westboro, Mass, so it could get snowy. And they had these three blades, and he kept talking about how, you know, what a deal, and he got him off TV or something. So this big snowstorm came and he was out there in the cold putting them on. We get in the car and we start to drive away. He turns them on and they both instantly fly off the car, just flew right away. No. On the first wipe, they just detached. Oh my God, I can still feel like the, and I had to repress my laughter because I knew it. He was angry.
Yeah.
But today I think you would think it was funny. But at the time I remember just looking the other way out the window just in, you know, for 5 minutes and laughing. Anyway,
my dad, when he retired, he bought this boat. It was an O'Day Mariner. It's like a 22-foot day sailor thing. And there's just so much work that went into it that he did all himself. But you got to paint the bottom with this special paint so the barnacles don't get on it. And
yeah.
You got to find a place, you know, to get a buoy, which was in this harbor called Aries Pond that was a harbor. And then you had to navigate this channel by motor to get out into a Pleasant Bay, which is a nice place to sail. So his whole focus of his year was getting out there. And so we get on the boat for the first time out there and we're on our way in the channel. And he drops the centerboard and the chain of the centerboard breaks and it just falls off into the water. And he, you know, he's someone who kept such a tight lid on things. And he was just like, fucking goddamn shit, motherfucking goddamn fucking centerboard. I just spent all year and I just had to do all this shit. And I fucking centerboard. And just like just, you know, on TV you'd hear, it's just 40 minutes of, you could just see everything he was angry about in his life in the 70 years up to that point coming to a head.
That's so
in that
funny.
Moment.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Anyway, that's every day of my life now.
Right. All I could think of was Jay Giles' centerboard. When that happened. I just lost my centerboard. So now we, speaking of boats, hey, we have some sad news. Speaking of boats. We lost a legend this week. We lost a big one. Captain Steubing of the Love Boat, a.k.a. Gavin McLeod, has passed away.
He gone!
This was sad for us because Goldie, you and I, and JC, I don't know how you feel about it, but we, Goldie and I, have a special place in our heart for the Love Boat.
I grew up watching this, and actually, I would say in a way, it's sort of what made me a TV writer. My brother and I... there were times my grandmother came to live with us, and so we started sharing a room. And as we fell asleep at night, we would together come up with Love Boat episodes.
Oh my God.
We were like 8 and 6.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah. And we would just say, you know, and then Gopher would have forgotten his uniform that week. You know?
Oh my God. By the way, that's episode quality for the Love Boat already. Like Gopher forgetting his, losing his uniform is totally a Love Boat.
Well, I just think with Captain Steubing, it really is, there is a poignancy for me, a genuine poignancy, in that I think he's sort of the last of a certain type of authority figure that was kind of ubiquitous when we were kids, which was the guy who maybe dressed buffoonishly and was bald and clownish, but had everyone's genuine fear and respect. Like now that character is played like by Steve Carell, and they're always just sort of a complete joke.
Right.
Like
right.
On some level, they're, you know, we're not supposed to take them seriously, but the crew was legit afraid of him.
Absolutely.
And he was a veteran.
Right.
Yeah. And he was very judgmental and he didn't drink because he almost ran over a kid once.
Oh, yeah. God, you remember all this stuff.
I don't remember that.
I guess because it just recently got put up on, what, Peacock or one of the...
CBS.
The CBS.
Which is now suddenly Paramount, right?
Oh, is that what it is?
I think so.
Oh.
Okay, because I got that CBS. Yeah, so, all right, good. I can still go on Paramount because, yeah, I watched some of them too, and they're just... And you're totally right about that authority figure thing. Like, the crew... They don't want him to know anything. Every episode is like, the captain can't know.
Hide you
know,
it
it's
from
like
him.
The captain can't know that I have a chimpanzee in my cabin. Oh, that's
well,
one of them.
It's also writing used to be so much more fun because okay, so the episode where Gopher has a chimpanzee Louise stuck in his cabin.
Right.
Like, I can't tell you how many meetings I was in with both of my shows, which failed almost instantly, where the executive's whole complaint about everything was, is this grounded? How do we know? How is it grounded? So here's how they justify the chimpanzee being on the boat in the Love Boat. Is Gopher comes on board with a chimpanzee. Julie says, what are you doing with a chimpanzee? And he says, I promised a friend I'd take care of it. I thought I had the week off, but I don't.
And that's it.
And then it's like, and we're off and running, and there's a chimpanzee on
but
the boat
by the
named Louise who steals jewelry.
I by the way, I love that kind of storytelling. Like, and
of course.
I think we do that on Family Guy. It's like, you know, Peter comes home and says, I bought a horse.
Yes.
And then you
right.
just do an act
the audience
of horse
doesn't
joke.
Care. They want to no. see a funny horse. They want to see a funny chimpanzee. They're not like, okay, so I went to an exotic animal farm and...
Right, make it believable.
Right. From there, I was purchasing it for a wealthier client who, as I was on my way to the house, said, can you hold him in your house? All this backstory. No
right.
one cares. They see
I'm
a chip.
Exhausted.
Yeah.
They're happy. They're happy that
yeah.
Gopher, who's a dork.
Right.
Totally.
Is in possession of a chimpanzee who's mischievous. And this is why we tune
and
in.
Go.
Yes.
And just go. Just, you're off and running. And
yeah.
by the way, Fred Grandy, let's not shortchange him, multi-term congressman from, I forget which state, he ran for Congress after Love Boat. And
his son is very like an accomplished comedy writer.
Really?
Charlie Grandy.
That's his son?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow, what a family, huh?
I know.
Well, anyway, but let's not shit on Gavin McLeod's grave.
No,
not
far
talking
from it.
About him some
What's
more.
What's the opposite of taking a piss on someone's grave? I'm doing it right now.
Putting a piss back in on someone's grave. You're taking one away.
I go to his grave, and if I see urine there, I put it in my own body.
Reverse.
That's good. That's how you honor.
I'm dehydrating McLeod's grave. That's how much I venerate him.
And now, Goldie, because I know you watched recently... Did you notice when you watched, because I sure did, when I was going through season one of The Love Boat, and again, not to piss on his grave, that no. the man looked like he might have been having fun during
oh, yeah.
the filming.
I agree.
Like he looked,
I always thought that.
His eyes were bloodshot a lot, and a lot of the show is close-ups.
Yeah.
Oh, McLeod?
So
yeah.
Oh, I didn't notice
I thought
that
he was
at
a
all.
Drinker.
Yeah, was that right? And maybe that's the reference to faith in his book. Usually when someone drinks a lot and hits rock bottom, then
maybe,
faith comes
yeah.
suddenly. So
I will say he has bewitching blue
he
eyes.
Does.
He
very
does.
Very intense.
They are piercing.
Yes. Ooh.
Piercing blue eyes. But he's gone, and we appreciated him. He made an impact on our lives. And Goldie, it sounds like, you know, he started this whole writing engine going for you.
He gone! That's...
Sorry, I had to do it again.
We already knew that.
He continues to be gone.
Yeah, it seemed gratuitous.
I know it was.
But of course, you know, Gavin McLeod, very popular in the 70s. He was on Mary Tyler Moore Show, into Love Boat in the 80s. Who else was the king around that time? Johnny Carson. I think it's time for Johnny Jokes.
It's Johnny's!
Oh, I love it. I love it. Okay, so this is a part of the show where we tell Carson-style monologue jokes because we grew up watching Johnny Carson, and the first jokes we ever tried to write to help us get jobs as writers were these kinds of jokes. Goldie, I know I used to look through the back of USA Today that have that state by state with little boxes and little weird stories from each state. That was always kind of a gold mine for these kinds of jokes. All right, so let's get into it this week. I'll go first because I know that's how it's going to go, so Goldie can ramp up his impression. All right, here we go. I should have more water for Johnny jokes. Getting a little lip smacky. Here we go. all good things must come to an end. A future Hall of Fame kicker, Adam Vinatieri, has announced that he's retiring from the NFL after 24 seasons. Yeah. Fans of the kicker were disappointed when the news hit the post. Thank you very much.
That's very good. I'm now nervous because mine suck.
No.
Oh, come on. All right, here we go. I think that I may have peaked already, so fear not. Now, this is a nice story. With COVID restrictions easing up, Boston's Fenway Park had their first game back at full capacity. Just terrific. And as an added attraction, Senator Ted Kennedy was there to throw up the opening pitch. Slowly going downward. I was holding for the laugh.
Yeah, I didn't know that when we wrote these jokes, we were also existing in 1981.
I know. I'm having. You know, hey, you wrote the time travel show. I'm just having a little fun. These can be anachronistic, Johnny.
Look at where the time travel show got me. You're in your guest house. I'm in my house, which is smaller than your guest house.
All right, settle down. Here we go. Continuing with the Johnny jokes. Hoping to redeem myself for that last one. Tal didn't like that last one. I should have listened to her. Okay, here we go. Former 8-term congressman Lester Wolf died earlier this week at the age of 102. Wear a mask, people.
See, that's
all
great.
Right, and that's going great. Into the last one, the last joke. here's an interesting story. Earlier this week, a corporate giant Amazon came out in favor of the federal legalization of marijuana. Gee, I guess I know why my package is smiling. And that's it.
I'm already calling it for you. I'm already calling it for you.
No, this isn't a competition, Johnny. I mean, technically, you are supposed to be the closer. By your insistence to go second.
First.
All right. Let's hear it. I always love you, Oz.
All right. Well, do you see this? Gas may soon hit $7 a gallon. It's getting a lot more expensive. And I stopped in Encino to fuel up last night, and a sommelier handed me a gas list.
That was good.
Japan is preparing for Olympics in the time of COVID. There are all sorts of innovations to keep the athletes safe. There are sanitizing stations, robotic janitors, and the entire stadium is now behind a sneeze guard.
That's good. Sneeze guard is a very good punchline for
okay.
him.
Okay. I don't know. All right, well, if you liked that, a California woman was reunited with a wallet that she lost 46 years ago. Ooh. And wouldn't you know it, everything was still inside. Yeah, it was so old.
How old was it?
The money showed George Washington as a baby. I hate these, and you guys are either very nice or you're somehow pranking me.
No, we're laughing.
Okay. All right. Well, here we go. Here's the last one.
All right.
All right. This is a little dirtier than Johnny usually goes. This is kind of blue. Ooh. So that final year when he knew he was just gone. A pornographic-themed cryptocurrency called Cum Rocket is soaring after Elon Musk tweeted about it. It's a real story. Now, to each his own, but if you're going to put this money where your mouth is, please get tested.
Oh, that was great. Your lack of self-confidence is crazy.
But did you ever have those days on Kilborn, or maybe you didn't do monologue jokes, where there were days where you were so confident sometimes, and you were like, he's just going to go nuts. I have 30 great jokes here.
Yes.
And then it would get in, and as one doesn't work, you get this feeling, and you're like, that's really weird. And then another doesn't work, and you get this worse feeling, and you're just like, I understand nothing. And you're so demoralized. And then, you know, there are those other days like today where you walk in and you go, I'm going to get fired. Like, this is absurd. These are terrible.
Well, I can't get fired.
But you know what I'm saying? That, you know, on Family Guy yesterday, you know, there was that thing where a bunch of cutaways came in and
yeah,
no one from that room was in our room. But you just know that had we all been in a room together, I started feeling almost sick as it went worse and worse, and we were getting toward the end.
I know. Yeah, that was rough. But I was also going to bring up from yesterday at Family Guy, you carried it. There was a scene there. I can't even remember what it was now, but we were just struggling. Oh, it was when they were like leaving the clam after a day of drinking. And we were sitting there for a while and just not really getting much going. And then it was like you got up and just slapped a double into the gaff. And I was like, oh, okay, here we go. We can do this now. And then, of course, there was no offense after that until your next time up when you slapped another double into the gap. But you were doing quite well yesterday. You had pretty much pitched that whole scene.
I will say to anyone out there who's a writer or trying to be a writer, every joke I make feels like it was my last.
Well, you know what? Maybe that's a blessing for you. Maybe you just throw everything you got into it.
Right. That's your motivation.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, when you're going to die, like one of these breaths is going to be the last one. You ever just start thinking about that? And you're just like, was it this one?
Well, Goldie, we all still have a 4 in front of our ages. I don't think we need to start thinking about that stuff yet.
Ooh, yeah. That's all I think about.
I know, JC, you're close.
I know.
The clock is ticking. You'll be fine. Are you kidding me? You're the healthiest one among us by far.
I don't know about that.
The only reason I look alive is because I got a ring light. That's it.
I have a ring light. I'm just this purple.
Oh, God. All right, so we tweeted this out earlier, the theme to this week's show. Which is, it seems like a kind of a narrow theme, but in actuality, I think it's kind of broadening by the day. So the theme of today is, so you've just been hired for your first writing job. What can you expect that first week in the writer's room and at work in general?
Yeah.
And it seemed like a narrow idea to me, but then, you know, all the stuff we've been looking at about the Gen Z kids and how many of them want to be writers, and there are so many new shows now that are opening up that there just have to be many more newer writers going to work wondering, what am I walking into? So Goldie, let's try and tell them some of our experiences in that realm.
I mean, I'll tell you why I proposed it was that to me, it's like,
we get it. It was your idea. Okay, fine.
Yeah. Well, I need to let them know.
I know. It was very subtle.
When you have a kid, the pregnancy is such a huge deal. Like, it's like, oh, what's going to happen at what stage of the pregnancy? And then you get this birth plan, you go to the hospital and they instantly laugh at you because they're like, we've done a million of these, your stupid plan's worthless. But I think people get so into the birth that they forget that that's not the end of the race. That's the start of the race. And that none of it matters once the kid is there. Like, all of a sudden you're dealing with something with constant needs. And I think it's the same thing with writing jobs, in that it's so hard to get a job, and there's so much focus on your specs and these interviews, and then you get the job and it's like, well, no one cares that you did that. And you're going to walk in your first day, you're going to have no idea what your hours are.
Right.
Unlike every other job.
Right.
You know, where I've worked in supermarkets or camp counselor or whatever. Like, you're going to get there and it's like, you might work normal hours, 8 hours a day, or you might be working for a psychopath who hates their family.
Right.
Who is there 18 hours a day?
Yep.
You might work for someone who starts right in and just goes, okay, let's open our scripts, please. Or it might be someone who hates writing as much as we do, and you get in and there's just open-ended discussion about everything.
Yes.
To get to lunch, and then you get to the lunch break and you'll be panicking in your office. We haven't done anything yet.
Right.
And then there'll be the post-lunch break, sort of 2 hours of discussion. And you might not start till 4, and like, you know, you might have concert tickets. And so your life can be completely upended. I think people don't think about this.
Yeah.
And they don't even know this necessarily.
It's true. It's true. And I remember I had two vastly different experiences. And actually, you can speak to both of these because we did basically the same thing. So when I got my first ever job at Late Late Show with Craig Kilborn, I showed up not really knowing what to expect in the writer's room. And it was strange and different from any experience that I had after that. We would sit in a room, somebody's office. We would bring all of the jokes that we had written for the show that day, go through each person. They would each read them aloud in front of our boss, who was Billy Kimball. He was the showrunner at the time. And it was, I remember it was unnerving because it was like, holy shit, I have to go in and read these jokes in front of like 7 people I don't know, and they're going to judge me. And Billy, who I thought was actually a really good showrunner because of something we were talking about earlier, he lived slightly in that past generation where the boss was to be feared.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's a funny guy, he's a sharp guy, but he also has a sharp tongue and he's not afraid to use it. And that was, you know, it kept us all incredibly on our toes. And also, I realized right away that a couple of the writers really sucked. So I was never going to be that bad. Right. So I was instantly like very comfortable, like, okay, well, I can, on my worst day, I'm funnier than these guys.
Right.
So that was a weird experience. And I guess that totally changed by the time you got to Kilborn. It was a much different vibe.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs. A gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Different boss. Yeah, I mean, I came from doing stand-up, and I'll tell a story in another episode of how I got my job and wound up there. But basically, I'd never been to L.A. before. I got my job by emailing jokes. I knew you on the show, but you had left, so I didn't know anybody. So I show up, and they say, we're going to start, I think it was at 9:30. And so I knowing I didn't want to face a blank document, I get there at 6:30.
Nice.
But I don't have a CBS ID.
Oh, no.
So I'm just sitting on the lawn in front of the gate for hours. And then Mike Gibbons, the boss, drives in and sees me sitting there. He's like, what are you doing? And I had been like just trying to memorize a series of jokes for 3 hours. And then he was like, you don't need to do that. But it made me, that was my version. That was when I started to feel good, because I said, oh, I'm going to work harder than anyone here, because this is so much more important to me than anyone.
You're a rare combination of writer where you're, I think, having worked with you many times, that you are the funniest person in the room, but you work way harder than you should. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have
never out of fight or flight.
Right.
I experience no moments of relaxation.
So you work very hard all the time. Like, you don't check out, you know, which
that's
a lot
of people.
That's
a good quality.
I mean, It is. I mean, I check out all the time. So, I mean, I admire.
I want to check out.
I know. I wish we could meet somewhere in the middle where I check out less, you check out a little more. That's good encouragement for work. Check out more, Goldie. That'll help us out. But a contrasting experience was the first writer's room I worked in the world of sitcoms, which was like 3 years later, was a short-lived show in 2002 on Fox called The Pitts. Mm-hmm. And it was run by, obviously, our great friend Mike Scully and his wife Julie Scully. And that writer's room, when I went into that writer's room, the people in there, and we could do whole shows on Tom Gamble, you know.
Yeah.
Tom Gamble and Max Pross are a legendary writing team in the comedy world. If you see their names on Seinfeld, Saturday Night Live, Letterman, The Simpsons, I mean, they've been everywhere.
Gary Shandling.
Dads. The list goes on. I think Curb. But so Tom Gamble is one of those characters, and you are so happy the minute you are introduced to him. Because, first of all, his voice is so disarming. Like, he has such a unique kind of voice. It's like this. Hey, how are you? Nice to meet you. And you're instantly already kind of, like, charmed by this. And then he is so funny and silly. Like, this is, we'll do a whole show on like, the different characters in writer's rooms. But he is a specific character in a writer's room and just a legendary one. So working in that writer's room, and Mike Scully obviously is the same way. He's as funny as they come and as nice as they come to writers. So going into the sitcom world, first week on that show, I was in awe looking around at these people, but they made me feel so comfortable. You know, I never felt tense like, oh my God, I should say more or I should say less or I shouldn't have said that. There was none of that in that room. So in terms of coming to that world, I had the best possible experience there was.
Yeah, and I think that points to that if you are the new person, maybe just look around and assess what's going on before you just get the resolve to go in and dominate.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And just put your mark all over everything. Because it's in a sense, you may be sort of surprised by how little is expected of you in a sitcom room. Because I know coming from late night where, okay, I got to write 25 monologue jokes in the morning, and then I've got to help get the desk piece ready. And then Craig Kilborn did this In the News thing that was sort of almost a second monologue, but it was a newscast parody.
Yeah, it was
and
a
then
weekend
I was
update.
I was also administrating the five questions segment. So all day I was scrambling and really regimented of how much writing and how much work I had to do. Then all of a sudden I got hired on the Cleveland show a few years later, and there's 14 writers. I'm accustomed to writing scripts by myself and having to churn stuff out. And then it's like, yeah, we'll take a week and go over this episode. And I was just sort of felt like I was crazy.
Right.
Because I was panicked that we're doing too little.
Right. I know exactly what you mean. You know, I think a lot of the things that people think of when they're heading into a job like that, it's, you hit the nail on the head in terms of just don't go in there and try to instantly be the funniest, loudest, most pitching person in the room. Like you said, look around, take the temperature of the room, read the other people in the room, try and figure out, okay, these are the EPs, the executive producers on the show. They're at a high level. How much are they weighing in? What is their vibe with the younger people on the staff? Like, does everybody kind of jovial with each other? Are people who have been there maybe, you know, a little longer than you deferential to the older people? It's like you should take your social cues the way you would a kind of in any situation, almost like a, you know, like a high school party in a weird way, where you just try and survey the scene and see where you can do the most good. But I think that you also said earlier, which is so true, that the types of shows and the types of showrunners will dictate whether your life will be fantastic or a living hell. There are legendarily certain showrunners that just keep their writers there to all hours. And sometimes you know, I'll hear like the particular show that they're staying late on. And I'm like, oh my God, you guys are staying until 2 a.m. for that fucking show. It's like, you could just leave at 4, you know,
well, the worse the show sometimes it's a symptom of a bad show.
That makes sense.
I know
that's what's happening, but I'll also, you know, to almost go against our original thought though, don't wait too long to say anything, because the longer people look at you that you haven't said anything, if it stretches into days or a week, that first thing you say will be so weighted with the expectation of what is this person going to do? I mean, my advice is to just find some small area or joke they're pitching on or some part of the story. Throw a test balloon out there early, just so you've broken the ice and said something.
Right.
So that people aren't 2 or 3 days in sort of starting to clock, boy, that person has not talked.
Yes.
Is there something weird going on? And then you can get in your own head of like, oh God, I haven't talked. How do I talk? And then for sure, the first time you talk, someone else will try to talk at the same moment.
Always.
Yes.
And then they'll go, no, you first, because you haven't talked. And then whatever you say will never work.
Right.
Yep.
It'll always be awkward. It's
been drum rolled too much.
Yeah. I would also say that particularly that first month is you've really got to be on your toes, because once in a while, someone will, at a point where people are stuck, just say, well, let's see what the new person thinks. And throw to you.
Yes. But that's usually, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's usually in terms of like a story point. Right?
Yeah, I mean, right. No one will throw to you for a joke. I mean, unless they're a complete asshole.
Right. Or totally kidding.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right. Where if there is some kind of story impasse where a couple people can't quite agree on something and they say like, well, let's ask the room what they think. You know, what do the rest of you guys think? Have something ready and have it
say something sense. Then. You have to. You have to.
Yes. You have to say something when prompted.
Yes. Here's one great phrase to help you be a good employee. Hey, I was just thinking about that blank. Hmm. This can be in the form of an email, a text, but it lets the person running know that outside of the room, you are giving consideration to a problem. Maybe it's an ongoing problem. Maybe it's a story that needs breaking, or maybe it's a future episode, or maybe it's how to use a guest star. And it just lets them know you're locked in with a show.
Totally.
You're a team player and your idea might be used. And as a showrunner, you're always looking for those. You're looking for a million ideas. But someone who comes in and solves a problem that you didn't specifically assign them.
Amazing.
In a way that is quick
and
discreet, doesn't bring everything to a screeching halt, but potentially offers a lifeline to a busy person. That's the type of thing that will keep you employed for 15 years. Hey, totally. I was just thinking about.
But quick is also a good point, though. Being quick, not like super verbose. And, you know, I think that's really
and
great
not
advice.
In front of everyone necessarily, because it's as a leader, it's embarrassing to not know what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Also, try to avoid keeping score of, well, that was my idea and I want everyone to know it's my idea, because that seems so important when you're coming up. But again, as someone who's running things, You're dealing with simultaneous episodes, maybe next season's arc, and the provenance of one particular part of one idea is of such little importance to you. The more important thing is everything's going well and things are on track. And if whoever's the leader thinks that, you will get renewed in a second season if the thing goes. But if you start just get really digging in and trying to get credit for what you think is some enormous thing that to this person is just a piece of a component, you're going to go quickly from like a place of gratitude to one of annoyance.
And that's a great point. And I would tag on to that. We understand this feeling you have inside, the need to get credit for things that you pitch and then you come up with. I know personally how strong that urge can be to take credit for something that you've done. But it's always better to let others either figure it out for themselves, let someone else give you the credit for something, or maybe just swallow the fact that you didn't get credit for that, but you know you did it.
It happened yesterday. It happened yesterday in the room we were in, where we were going through that scene, and then it's like, can we go back? Someone said this, and it's like, someone? Me! I said it! I was the one who had the idea, and I want everyone to know. But, you know, of course you have to sit on that.
Oh, I know that feeling, too.
And it hurts. It hurts
every
time.
And then
you're
just praying. You're going like, please, someone else say it was me, that I was the someone, so I don't have to be the one who says it. Or like, can two synapses connect and they'll remember that someone was Goldie. And then this thing in my brain that's making me want to scream, it was me, can go away.
Yes. No, and clearly, I mean, because I feel it too, and you've clearly felt it yesterday.
25 years in.
It never goes away. The feeling that you want to be given credit for the jokes that you pitch or the stories that you come up with will never go away.
It's actually comforting to hear that from you guys who are so well established, that like you can go be this young writer and be like, oh, in my future, I'm going to get over this. Well, no, you won't.
You probably not.
It'll get worse.
I know. And the fact of the matter is, we all know this about each other, at least at Family Guy, because we worked together for so long. So Goldie knows that about me. I know it about, you know, whoever, Mike D, any of the writers on staff. Like, I know that when people pitch things, they want other people to know it. But we also know that it's kind of not cool to say it. It's just a little bit, it's tacky.
It's the same thing as when you give your dog a treat, you have to say good boy. It's crazy.
Oh, wow. And as a showrunner, is it one thing if you acknowledge somebody? Do you then feel like, well, if I acknowledge this person, then I have to acknowledge everybody?
No. Okay. No. And I, especially at Family Guy, you can't get caught up in that because we have like 20 plus people. So it'd be a never ending, you know, applause break of congratulations for people.
You're like T-ball.
Right. Exactly like T-ball. But no, I think that what we do like and appreciate is what we were talking about earlier. Like if Goldie were running a gag room, which we have at Family Guy, where there's a room of five or six people trying to come up with a specific joke. And if Goldie were running that room and then sent us a bunch of joke alts, we call them, to consider for a spot, we read them and we say, oh my God, this number four was so funny. And then if Goldie wants to say, oh, that was Matt Pabian, you know, or saying someone on staff, like actually, you know, Patrick Meegan came up with that. That's great. Like, that's a nice way for the credit to kind of make its way around. And generally, people go out of their way to do that with writers who are younger and coming up, where it's sort of like, you know who pitched that? Matt Pabian. And everyone's like, well, I guess he's working out. And it's so it's
we
a
all
nice...
collectively know that those people are at the most jeopardy.
Right.
Yeah.
Or those people are trying to latch on to this sort of, you know, slowly sinking money train of Family Guy. Like, so that they're trying to, that's the boat on a track. I said slowly sinking money train.
That's perfect.
Should have been Goldie wrote
the track itself is built on loam.
Loam. Good word. But so that's a good way for it to get credit. Have someone else give you credit. Wait for it to come from someone else, or just be okay with the fact that you'll always be a little bit annoyed about it.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to say, just to kind of button up this area, is another thing to do. You will get free lunches wherever you work. It'll be a new and exciting thing for you at first. You will be handed a menu. You will be asked to make a choice. Do not have any questions. Do not say, oh, can we go somewhere else? And make your order very small and simple to start with and gauge everyone else's orders. Like if people are ordering like three and four things, then maybe you can splurge a little bit, but keep it really simple. You don't want your order to draw any kind of attention. You don't want to be known as the guy who gets like a lunch tower of like four things.
Especially because whoever is getting your lunch, if you're new, will hate you specifically.
Will hate you because they want your job.
Yes, and they think they should have gotten it. And you are so close to switching positions with them.
Yeah.
And due to some luck or just a little bit more skill, you have your job and they have theirs. And you're off starting your life. And they're thinking about moving back home and quitting.
Right.
So be nice to the person who's getting your lunch.
Yeah. So your side of broccoli may have some butter on it, even though you wrote no butter. Like, don't do it. Just whatever the food is, tough it out. It's free food. Just ride it out. I mean, believe me. 20% of being a writer is thinking about lunch, complaining
about
lunch.
Well, then when you sort of do make it to the top, it's like shocking to me how much people want to please you, and they'll just start coming to you with food. And then like the craft services person on my last show, I just don't eat that much because I'm getting older and I'm bald and I don't want to be.
What does being bald have to do with your appetite?
My physical appearance would be like a total disaster. But you could tell in some part of her head, she's like, he's in charge. I want him to enjoy my food. So she would just always come up to me with these, you know, plates, and they were great. But it's like, yeah, I don't eat at like 2:40. I eat once at noon and then again at like 7, a much smaller amount. Because if I do any more than that, I'll never recover this body that you see before you.
I just love the idea that people on your show are like coming and laying tributes at your feet, like tributes of food. Just kind of, sir, please.
Well, it's like, you know, have you tried the empanadas? And it's like,
empanada nothing.
First of all, like I'm right to be concerned this thing's about to be canceled. I'm not thinking about the empanadas. I'm thinking about like, can I start drinking in my office? Yeah. That's all
and
I'm
you,
thinking
and
about.
And it turns out you can.
And it turns out I did.
When you reach a certain level, you can do whatever you want in your office. That's another thing we don't talk about that much. But
nor should we.
All right. No, we shouldn't. We should probably edit that out.
Might be our last episode.
Right. Goodbye,
what you can
everyone.
Do in your office once you're right. in charge.
Yes. What we have done. Our top 5 stories. Well,
the best part of The Office to me was just like, oh my God, now
season
I can close the door and just start drilling them into the couch.
Wait, what?
Farting in your office.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I could see what you No, I just literally like...
Oh, you got buzzed.
The worst part for me, the first time I had an assistant was like, oh my God, now I can't hide from this person. And my stomach is a disaster.
Yeah, mine too. You got 2 Jews here, my friend. Yeah.
Oh, is that a thing? Anyway.
Oh yeah, Jewish stomachs are famously terrible.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Terrible.
It's a Grepsy. British car of a stomach.
Oh.
I know. British car of a stomach.
Wait,
just constantly
first
coughing
joke
up.
Of the day. First joke of the day.
You can't, an hour
you
ten.
Can't play that this what? Late. We already did the Johnny jokes. God.
I like we should just see play it later and later.
Yeah, every like week we'll be like 70 minutes in.
So it has to be before the Johnny jokes.
Well, I mean, it should
maybe
be
maybe just have a quick hand early.
What if there isn't one?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Then, well, if we haven't told a good joke for a whole episode, you can play Sarah Silverman's quote about that.
You're terrible at what you're paid to do.
Yep, she used to tell me that all the time. It was wonderful. Whenever I would make a bad pun, she would say that all the time. Little does she know that my entire empire is built on bad puns.
Or maybe she does know.
Yeah, she probably does know. Well, I don't know that we fulfilled every aspect of what to expect when you get your first writer's job. I mean, obviously, so let's go to some of the questions, some of the things we probably didn't think of. JC, I know we didn't have that much time to cultivate these, but are there any that, looking at them, stuck out to you?
Let's start with the one on top. How? Okay, this is from at Kevin McCallum.
Ooh. Is that the kid from Home Alone?
Maybe.
Okay, keep going.
How old is too old to begin trying to get your first ever TV writing job?
Goldie, you talked about this the other week. I don't think you can be too old, technically.
Technically, you can't be too old, but realistically, it's going to hurt and be harder to be older. And you have to decide if you want to try or not. But it's not going to be easy.
I agree. Like, it seems like it's easier to start younger for so many reasons. But if you're over 50, I think they're, you know, listen, I don't know all the shows. I'm sure there are a bunch of them. The Kaminsky Method, Gracie and Frankie, or whatever the hell that show is. There are a lot of shows now that are popular that are geared towards older people. And I'm sure they're looking for older writers.
I just don't want to mislead people, though. The writers on Gracie and Frankie were younger people. I don't want to mislead anyone into thinking that you want to start at 55 and like, is there a realistic shot at this? Arguably not. Is there an unrealistic shot? Yeah. Can anything happen in this world? Yeah. Sure. Are the odds with it? No.
No, the odds are against it. The odds are against everyone. They're even further stacked against older people. I would agree with that, who are just trying to break into the business.
Be extraordinary. Yeah, no.
That's advice for everyone. That's it's true.
I'm trying to give practical advice. Like,
yeah, and then all of a sudden you turned into the teacher in Dead Poets Society. Like, be extraordinary. Carpe diem.
Oh, no, I'm the one who would be mad they ripped out the pages.
Yes, the guy at the end.
Yes. Where are these books?
Yeah.
Look, if you don't want to read that part, don't read it. Don't destroy books are sacred. Don't destroy part of the book.
Oh, it was part of his method.
Look, if anyone wants to stand on the desk, you have a minute to do it.
Right.
Go ahead. Stand on your desk and do your whole rigmarole. Here's what I'll be doing. Writing stuff on the board for today's lesson. Because that stuff, we're done with him. Yeah. We're done with him. A kid killed himself, okay?
Oh.
So all that stuff. A kid did. Yeah. He killed himself. So, like, he doesn't get to play in the Shakespeare sandbox anymore.
Right. So, I like this. We went deep into Dead Poets Society there without really telling people. But, yes.
Yeah, be extraordinary.
Be extraordinary, says Professor Goldie. Thank you, boys. Let's go to our next question.
We have Sarah is okay, I guess. What's the worst reaction to a joke you pitched or when you felt like you didn't fit in with more experienced writers yet? And how did you become more confident?
Ooh, God, I think I try and block out all the bad jokes I've pitched. There have been many. I think the key there is, certainly at a place like Family Guy, you can't be afraid to make a bad pitch. Like, if you don't want your first pitch to be a bad pitch, like, you want to start off on the right foot. You want to show people you can be funny, but then you have to be willing to try and throw things out that don't always work. I can't particularly remember a situation where I felt like, I'm sure it's happened that I felt humiliated after pitching something stupid, but it didn't stick with me long enough. I think that's again, smoked pot for 30 years. So I forget things quickly. And so I think that's important in my line of work, especially with the amount of dumb puns that I say. Like, it's good that I just kind of forget them and kind of keep moving on. Goldie, can you think of anything? I mean, by the way, your jokes are excellent most of the time.
I've been fired before. I don't think you have.
Well, I was fired from SNL. We'll get into that another time.
Yeah, so I was fired by Craig Ferguson. And I'll say, if it's not working out...
Don't laugh.
And I didn't. but I'll say, you'll know if it's not working out. You'll feel it in every fiber of your being. And something that this may be a whole other episode, but you should always be looking for another job. Always.
Whoa, Goldie.
When you have a job.
Hot take.
We just brought you back on Family Guy here. This is not...
And I'm leaving.
He's got 1 foot out.
No. Really, the second you have a job, you should be writing other spec scripts. You should be looking around. You should still be in contact with your agent. You should be trying your hardest to make that situation work. But the job hunt should never end because... look, I've been out of work 3 days since 2002. That's not an accident. It's because I was always, always, always planning for failure. And you should as well. So I'll just say, like, I have, you know, there were entire weeks on a show where everyone hated everything I said. I got fired. I knew I was getting fired, but I was able to take the money while I was hanging on and being humiliated and getting angrier by the day. And I was able to marshal my resources, and the next day after they fired me, I walked into a different job because I had read the
TV. Your
base
is covered.
Right. I remember when you. I remember when you worked at Subway. Go ahead.
I would say take the humiliation, and it's gonna suck, but channel it into a job hunt if you really think it's that bad.
And I'm assuming, like, for writers, most shows come to an end. So that's another thing.
In my
thing.
Case, all shows come to an end.
I mean, it's something that I think writers always have in their mind, especially if you've been in you know, doing it for 10 plus, 20 plus years, you start to realize that you yourself have an expiration date. And just how long you can push that is, you know, up to being somehow savvy about the future of your career. Like, what can you, what can you latch on to next? Like, where will someone value you? Hopefully they're, you know, hopefully both of us have made a bullshit name for ourselves that somebody might actually want us to work somewhere. But we'll see. Yeah.
Well, if not, there's a new cryptocurrency called Cum Rocket.
Well, really, put your money where your mouth is.
Well, and I should actually maybe correct that. It's not just writers. It's anybody who works in television. We all expect that the show's going to end. It's just maybe we're lucky to be working on the longest running shows.
Right. You know, with well, our... we are now. We're lucky. Yeah. We're lucky to be on Family Guy now for sure.
And I just came from SNL, which is on what, season 40,000? You know?
It's That's a long time.
Me getting back to Family Guy was like the movie 1917.
Yeah, I know you said that.
Just an incredibly long, involved run to get somewhere where everyone's like, "Oh, you're here. You have a message." Oh,
okay. All right, sit down. Go ahead, sit down. We got another battle tomorrow. We got to run back to where you came from. We need you to deliver this back there. All right. Do we have another question?
Okay. From at Brent Garner, what is the worst table read you've been a part of?
Oh, good question.
Oh, well, Goldie, you had something for this.
Yeah. So one of the things when you're on an overall deal, which I used to be on, was they ask you to come help out on the pilots or the new shows that they're testing, and before they film these shows, they have a table read of the script. So I went to a table read. So this was a show that did not exist yet, but was trying to come into existence. And it was just sort of a very middle of the road comedy about someone's brother who was kind of a rogue moving back into their house.
And it was written, that sounds twisted.
It was written by a British guy. So right away, he introduced it, but he had a thick accent, and so, like, no one could really understand what he was saying. So it was the thing I was talking about earlier, where if you don't get that first laugh,
right,
people are waiting to see, like, where am I going to laugh in here? I want to laugh, but nothing's happened yet. And so on page two, there was an extended run about mulligatawny, which is a type of soup. Yeah.
Sure.
And it was clear that this was meant to be the gut-busting sort of comedy goldmine. But I and many other people, I think, were just kind of wondering, like, oh, that's a soup, right? Like, there was no instant recognition.
But clearly that person was being a little derivative of Seinfeld that had an episode, a famous episode with the soup Nazi, where the central soup was mulligatawny.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So in any case, after a pilot, like, typically what happens if you're helping out is the writers go to one room, and then whoever created the show goes in with the executives, and they meet and get notes, and they come back in anywhere from a half hour to an hour. So we're sitting there, a half hour goes by, an hour goes by. 2 hours goes by. And one of the producers of the show was Tom Werner, who, famous television producer, also part owner of the Boston Red Sox. So as we're waiting, I started talking to him, telling him what a huge Boston fan I am. And so he, you know, this was like 20 minutes after the table read, he was just saying, like, hey, you know, call me if you ever want to go to a game. And he gave me some email. So as as 3 hours go by, 4 hours go by, and then it just comes back, we're not doing notes. So, you know, like,
it was a disaster.
This is gone. It was a laugh-free disaster. But then I always kind of wanted to call Tom Werner and go, hey, do you remember that pilot that was so bad? We didn't even get notes. They just totally called it off. I was sitting in that room and I was like VIP treatment at a hard to get Red Sox game.
Oh, my God. That's so funny.
You said in the first 20 minutes, you told me to call you, and now the Yankees are playing the Red Sox in the playoffs, and I want tickets and a full VIP treatment.
Up.
Yeah. I want to meet Mookie Betts.
Yeah. So that was just an awful table read.
Did you go?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And so, JC, you had an interesting table read experience.
Okay, so I've mentioned I worked on SNL, and even though I'm an audio person, I was there for table reads. And I was there when Trump hosted during the election.
Oh.
So, which was a very interesting week, but this particular table read, there's this one moment where...
this is the 2016 election?
Yes.
I didn't remember that he hosted that.
He hosted because...
He was great.
Hillary hosted?
No, Hillary guested.
Right, in that sketch.
Goldie, I'm pretty sure this is one of your favorite episodes.
Yeah. It's my favorite episode of SNL when Donald Trump hosted.
That's a fun one.
I thought that was the best episode.
Yeah.
The best they've ever been.
Okay, and so, I'll tell that to anyone at any time. It's my all-time favorite episode of SNL was when Donald Trump hosted.
What's yours?
He was the best and the funniest host they've ever had.
Okay, so Trump has his phone in front of him, and apparently it rings. He picks it up, and he's like, yes, yes, great, great news. And then puts it down, and he's like, my book is number one on the New York Times. Yeah.
Doesn't sound like him.
And and then apparently I find out later that the phone never rang. He just picked it up and pretended.
He's a genius in a weird way.
He's like promoting to us his book. He was like
promoting
like
it. Such a like a follow the queen style like ruse on people. Like I'll do the old fake phone ring. Hello? Yeah. Really? Number one, you say? Let me tell everyone.
Literally.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess my only, I'm sure I've been to many bad table reads. Again, 30 years of pot, can't remember. But we've had many bad table reads at Family Guy. I mean, I've been there for like, 200 episodes or however many. We've had some clunkers in there, and that's a bad feeling because the table read, it's sort of the connection point between the writers and the rest, the production staff on the show. It's like when they come to sit in an arena and watch what we've been doing, what we've been, because oftentimes production can have this, or other people can have this view of the writer's room, like, oh, they just fuck off in there and they don't do anything and they get, they're overpaid and they're spoiled babies. And a lot of that's true.
And look at their cars.
I know. And so there's a resentment there, and you want to show them, no, we're good, we can write funny stuff. And I would say most of the time at Family Guy, we're able to do some version of that, where it's respectable to hilarious.
Yeah.
But there are some times when it's just clunkers, and you can hear individual coughs, people shifting in their chairs, and you're flipping ahead to see how many more pages, you're like, holy shit, we have 26 pages left.
The sound of paper turning with no other.
Yes.
Wow. No, not even courtesy laughs or anything?
No, we're past that because that's when they smell blood in the water. You don't get courtesy laughs.
No.
It's like, we're going to enjoy watching you guys go down on this one this week. And I get it. Believe me, I get it.
Yeah.
Like, I understand.
Oh, if I were on the staff, I would root for every script to suck.
Oh my God.
Yes. Exactly.
I totally would.
Look at those bozos.
Yeah.
I know, but we're different that way, which is why we're in the writer's room writing jokes, because so many of the guys on the production team are not like that. Like
they are genuinely awesome.
So many of the nicest guys. Yeah.
It's so confusing.
What, how someone can be that way?
Well, when you just meet someone who's like happy and nice and likes their job, and
I can't figure it out.
And loves to laugh.
I know. There's a wall with a hole punched in it at home with those people, though.
They take it out on somebody else.
Something happens. All right, do we wrap up the questions? We didn't help too many people. Maybe we helped someone.
I think you did. There's really valuable information there.
The important thing is we talked.
Yeah.
And as it says in the Talmud, if you save one life, you save the world entire. All right. So now we're going to move on to our top five list this week, which sort of connects to something we were talking about, about 2.5 hours ago. Captain Steubing passed away this week. Here you go. Don't play it again. We wanted to do a top five this week that kind of honored him, and I think you'll figure out what we mean. So the category this week is top five terrible but great TV shows. So obviously the tie-in with Steubing is pretty right. clear, and that might be one on my list. But it was a fun one to think about, and just to think of all the time I've wasted on these shows. But let's see. I'll just jump into it this week. Yeah. I feel like I always go last. Let me start at number five. Is that okay, yeah, JC, yeah, if I start okay. at five? All right, thanks. Number five, that's a running joke now. Yeah. Where JC wanted to start at number one. We were all like, that's probably not. So number five for me was The Brady Bunch. The Brady Bunch, I think, is a yes. terrible but yes. great show.
Yeah.
I watched The Brady Bunch for that hour block, Johnny, on Channel 56 every yeah. day, 4 to 5.
Oh.
And I think we all had I had a huge thing for Marsha Brady. She was just the hottest thing I'd ever seen.
Marsha.
And when I was like, 10, it was awesome. And everybody seemed kind of my age. I've seen so many of those, all of them,
yeah,
know them all very
choice.
Well.
I like Alice.
Number four, Alice, Ann B. Davis.
Oh, a working woman.
Ann B. Davis. Yeah, she was great. You know what? She was the glue. She was the glue. Held that family together. Number four for me, a little show called Melrose Place.
Ooh.
Okay.
Cool.
Melrose Place, as we all know, was a kind of in the Beverly Hills 90210 world. It was an yes. offshoot of it. I think the pilot was even a crossover with Bev Niner, as we call it in the biz. But Melrose Place is just like an adult soap opera where everyone was having sex and the women were gorgeous and yes. the men were assholes. And it was just really fun to watch. And it was very 90s, like as yeah. 90s as a show can be in terms of hair and
just
jeans.
Painters,
I remember
jeans.
That. Nice. Just absolutely. The jeans were absurd. And they're kind of coming back now, which is ridiculous to me. But a funny fact about, they call them fun facts, I believe now, about Melrose Place is that there was a workplace in Melrose Place called D&D Advertising, where a few of the characters worked. Heather Locklear was a boss there. I think Andrew Hsu worked there for a Ooh. Time. You know, like the characters were kind of working there from time to time. When they would show the exterior of D&D Advertising, just an exterior shot of the building, and then they'd go inside. The exterior of the building are the Family Guy offices.
Whoa.
Wow, fun
so
fact.
So the building where we work
wow.
in Family Guy was an exterior for Melrose
That's a
Place.
Good one. That's a good one.
Okay, now here we go. We'll cruise
the
through
Zoom window
three.
Where we work.
That's right. Okay, where we used to work, buddy. You get it. Number three for me, and RIP, he gone, The Love Boat. Love Boat was just fantastic week after week. The guests, just watching those guest stars pile up at the beginning, it just promised so much. And then it kind of delivered. And one thing that always amazes me about Love Boat, it always took three writers and three directors every week to come out with that kind of piece of shit. It was like the terrible story we talked about with the chimpanzee. That was one of three stories that was going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, but they don't really intersect the stories. That's how
they
that's
don't.
They
but
that. Yeah.
But like the idea that one writer could not come up with that schlocky dialogue for like three little mini stories is crazy to me. But God bless them. They worked for a while. All right, two, I sort of tipped this earlier, but Beverly Hills 90210, I loved it, loved
nice.
It. And my old writing partner, Wellesley, denies this, but I swear that it's true. We went to college together, and we would drive out to our friend's off-campus apartment on Thursday nights when these two shows were on back-to-back, Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place. And I was the jackass who had the car. And so I would go and I'd be literally slowing down to park and everyone in my car would be jumping out, running into the house to get like the better seats on the couch to watch these two shows. Like I just have vivid memories of people pushing people back downstairs, you know, to like come up and be sitting up in the chair like, fuck you, fuck you. But Wellesley denies it, but it's totally true. Okay, number one, and I bet this wasn't on any of your lists, but it should be. The number one terrible but great TV show for me was called T.J. Hooker.
Ooh.
That's a good one.
But is that a terrible show?
Yes.
Okay. Oh. JC, you have to treat yourself to this show. It's on whatever the local network is in your area that's like My TV, a collection of, you know, okay, old-timey TV, and it's got like Mayberry and all that shit. But okay. T.J. Hooker, William Shatner he gets a lot of attention for all the kind of overacting and bullshit. He is a great TV star. Like, they didn't write particularly well for him on T.J. Hooker. But he delivers the shit out of his lines. He gives every line. It's like, you know how Ted Knight in Caddyshack is so like, every line he delivers is electric because he's just like, well, you know, he's like 110% on the reactor. Shatner is like that through the whole series of T.J. Hooker. It's very fun to watch.
There are times in car chases on that show you can see a cameraman in the background.
Oh, cool.
Well, not only that, but there in many car chases, they use the same what we call B-roll. So it would be like a faraway shot of a car chase. And you'll notice if you watch the show a week later, they use the same B-roll of a car coming around the same corner with the same like red car in front of them. And but
saving money.
You got to check it out.
Okay.
All right. Who's
next? That's a great list. That's a great list.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Goldie, do you want to go or do you want
to go? Sure, I'll
go.
Okay. You want me?
Yeah, please.
I have a couple curveballs in here.
Mine are...
Oh, I love curveballs.
Yeah.
Okay, so number five is Love Boat. We've talked about it.
Nice.
Not going to say anymore.
Right.
Number four is the show, the original Dallas.
Ooh. Oh,
yes. That's great.
And I think one thing that we haven't touched on is just... A lot of these shows have an iconic theme song that when you just start to hear that, you're like, oh my God, I'm in. There's a Pavlovian response. Like, show me JR.
Very good call.
Show me Victoria Principal.
Yes.
Show me Sue Ellen.
Nice.
They're all bad. But I mean, it's like a whole season was a dream. I mean, it's a disaster of a show.
I know, but it was wildly popular.
Yeah.
Yeah. So number three, here's my first curveball, and it's a show I watch almost every episode of. Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel.
I totally agree with that.
Today,
that
is concussions. We followed up on a report with,
and he's so funny and weird and pompous, and it is really watchable, and I do enjoy it. But like, they always come up to him after the story, and he's taking notes, and it's like, what? Haven't you seen a cut of them? What are you taking notes on?
This is your show.
You have a prompter. Like, you're really going like, Steve, is it true? Is she happy now?
It's Steve, so I pretentious. Find out,
are they still going to do that bike race next year, Steve? Do you think the UCI will... Do you think Sepp Blatter will change his behavior in the upcoming... Have they learned any...
Like, it's just like if you just did a bunch of stuff and then a dweeb as you were leaving work went, oh, are you sure they...
Did you order the right lunch? Did you... Is that,
anyway, well, I love and it. And the correspondents are like a morose island.
I was just going to say that. The correspondents look like the Laugh Olympics cartoon. It's like they are like Frank DeFord looks like he was dead. Yes. He looked like he was Dracula. And then they have that weird young guy like John Frankheimer who looks like a weird sort of like wolf man.
And the guy had Bernard or whatever. And he was like kind of an Andy Rooney like.
Yes.
You know, cranky. Yes. They put the stickum on their hands and they throw a pitch, that is an advantage. It's an advantage and it puts all the record books in question. Like, no one cares about baseball records anymore.
Well, and also you can tell how Gumball feels about each correspondent, yes, based on the way he talks to them after their story. Yes. And he doesn't, I don't think he likes that guy we just mentioned.
Well, I think that guy got fired. He got
I think you're right. He was just sort of the joke story guy. It was like, who'd have thought you could rollerblade across America? It's like, we don't want this story. Like, yes, let's hear about Russian cycling doping. I don't care about this.
Well, I'm glad to have found a consensus.
That
here,
was a great was,
as I,
pick.
As I put
great.
It on the list, I was worried that it would go
a
either
fantastic
way.
Pick.
Yeah. Number two, again, this is now maybe I'm trying to get a hot take here. Friends, it's not that good.
Oh.
You
yeah,
know,
I couldn't agree with you more.
It's fair. It's fair.
But by the way.
But great, but not good.
Terrible, but great.
I don't
it's
know.
It's not really funny.
I don't know exactly how to define Friends. It's so weird. I have such a strange relationship with it. I think
it's for 12-year-olds. It's childish.
I think you're right.
It's a child's view of New York. It's a child's view of dating. It's child's
fair.
View of sex. A child's view of marriage. And that's not a bad thing. Like, there's childlike wonder, which we all... But it's not something that, like, as an adult, I find genuine connection with. It's more like, this is a nice... fantasy right. world and it's,
fantasy right. world I think yeah. is good. Like, it's nothing like New York. I mean, not even close.
No. Yes. No.
So yeah, I mean,
but I'm almost chomping at the bit to get to my number one.
Okay, right, okay.
My number one good bad show, because I think what a legacy, and they've rejuvenated it with a new host, and it's an all-time classic, America's Funniest Home Video.
I was thinking about that one.
Because Tom Bergeron had gotten negative. He'd come to enjoy people getting hurt. He'd gotten sadistic. And there would be glee when someone would hit the guard. And now Alfonso Ribeiro plays it with a light touch. He's like a dancer. He does the amount of comedy. He does some shtick.
Oh.
And he's a good guy.
He's
and they've made
good,
it. You sit down with your kids to watch this show, I defy you to not laugh 10 times an episode.
That is a great choice.
I agree. When it first came on, you had to fight me to stay away from the TV. Like, I could
appointment
not miss an
TV.
Episode
yes.
of that.
Yeah. Knocking
appointment
your mom
TV,
out of
absolutely.
Way.
Yes, like, I have to see this show.
Yes.
That's a great choice. Great. Your lists were all great.
Yeah.
But you know what?
Thank
we all did a good job. Let's just
well,
admit
yeah.
it.
Well, I haven't done my list
yeah.
yet.
We got to hear JC.
You know what? JC, in particular, your list was fantastic. It made a big impression
so
on me.
So great. It really clearly did. And you know, actually, my list, you may have only heard of maybe one of the shows. But
oh, that's fun. That's fun.
Yeah, it'll be quick. So, right, and I will say that I've learned a lot about myself, and that I really enjoy a very specific type of show. So okay. My number five is, it ran for one season. It is a show called Limitless, which was based off of the movie Limitless.
The movie Limitless.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he basically takes a pill called NZT, and he's the smartest guy in the world. He's an FBI agent and then solves mysteries and blah, blah, blah. So
right.
Number four is a show called Haven.
Haven.
Which, yes, Haven. Sci-fi network.
No.
I love science fiction. I had to remove like three shows from the Sci-Fi Network on here.
What's it about?
It is about another FBI agent who gets sent to a town called Haven to solve the mysteries of a town. And these mysteries are called the Troubles, where they're all like supernatural mysteries. And it's based off of a Stephen King short story called The Colorado Kid.
Okay. Oh, I've heard of Stephen King.
Yes, you've heard of Stephen. Okay, so number three, you've heard of, I feel like you may have heard of this show, is called The O.C.
Well, yes.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The O.C., Olivia
sure.
Wilde.
Welcome to The O.C.,
up.
Bitch.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, that was the big pilot punch.
Yes.
People hadn't heard bitch that much back then.
Right. I know. No, it was still a shocking word at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, now.
Yeah.
For TV.
Number two is Grimm.
Yeah.
Grimm
oh, that one
on NBC.
Of.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, that was must-see TV. New episodes. Another fantasy police procedural Eesh. Crime drama. Like,
I'm seeing a lifetime of LARPing with you.
Weirdly, there isn't. But I'm surprised I haven't. and also Reggie Lee, who's, I don't know if he's been on Family Guy, but he's on American Dad a lot. He is
he was on Grimm.
Yeah. Shout out to Reggie Lee. And then number one is a show called Psych.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
USA Network.
Sure. But
that's bad?
I don't know. I mean, nobody I know has ever seen it. I don't know.
I don't know. I think I can see why you would say that, because I think that it's one of those shows that sort of catches a little flack for being what it is, and yet has somehow been on for like 8 seasons, right?
It was, I think, 5 or 6 seasons. I've seen the show through and through 8 times, maybe.
Is it Alan
Tudyk? That's a whole lot of Psych!
No, it's James Rodet and Dulé Hill.
Rodet all day.
And they're hilarious. I think they're so funny. And of course,
Rodet Olay Drive.
There you go.
Ooh, nice. Yeah. More mysteries to solve. He pretends he's a psychic.
Right.
Just like there's a theme. So.
All right.
And
well, that feels like a curated list.
I know.
Very difficult topic for me. You said don't think about it too much. More than any other list we've had, this was the hardest one for me.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, next week we'll make a less challenging list for all of us.
Okay.
Yeah. 5 favorite pizza toppings. No, we're not doing that because I only like 2, I think.
Nah, so. I like none.
Oh,
all right. I've had to take a piss for an hour. So thanks again for joining us on our 3rd episode of A Typical Disgusting Display.
Alrighty.
With Goldie and the Sulk. Hopefully, we will see you next week.
Typical, disgusting display.